And we found through our survey statistically that people who feel called to their work are more likely to say that people should just, you know, kind of, this sounds too pejorative, but kind of suck it up and go about their workaday business, that they are less likely to notice other people's struggles as well. And so there is this kind of two-sidedness towards calling that we want to point out. And I think our critical listeners will feel blessed by that too. Just make sure that we aren't at all Pollyanna-ish. Calling does not have to be inconsistent with seeking justice in workplaces.
Because people are spending so much of their time in the workplace, and so you think broadly, if you're working full-time, you've got 40 hours a week, that's a significant part of your life. If you're spending a significant part of your life in any given place, what is it? What does that mean for how you live out your faith? What does God want you to be doing there? How is that place shaping you? What does God want for you in the context of that faith-shaping experience, whether you think it is or not? And how are you living out your life as a Christian in every aspect of your life, but particularly in the church, in the workplace?
Welcome to the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. My name is John Terrell, and today I have a conversation with Elaine Howard Eklund and Denise Daniels, authors of the new book, Working for Better, A New Approach to Faith at Work. Elaine Howard Eklund is the Herbert S. Autry Chair in Social Sciences, Professor of Sociology, and Director of the Boniek Institute at Rice University. Denise Daniels is Hudson T. Harrison Professor of Entrepreneurship at Wheaton College. Today we discuss calling, rest, tensions in living our faith at work, and how we can expand our vision of sacred work to include the radical embrace of others. I love the book, thoroughly enjoyed talking to Denise and Elaine, and I'm excited to welcome you into the conversation. Okay, well, I have been looking forward to this conversation. Denise and Elaine, it is so good to have you on the Upwards Podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed your book, and the timing of this is really perfect because the book comes out, I think, about the day the podcast is released. So the timing is excellent. And this really is a new approach or a new angle on the faith at work movement. And so I'm really excited to lean into this conversation with you. Thank you for your willingness to have this conversation.
Well, thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
It's nice to be here. We appreciate the chance to have a chance to talk to you.
Yep, we sure do.
Well, I have been looking forward to it. I know you two have a longstanding friendship, and I'd love to hear, I know our listeners would love to hear how you've first met and what's been the nature of your collaboration over the years.
Yeah, so Denise and I were part of a seminar on leadership through the HEB Foundation Laity Lodge, and we're both walkers. We love to walk to release stress, and we started walking together, and as two researchers do when they become friends, we started dreaming of future research projects. So after the seminar was over, we thought we'd like to keep in touch. And it's like the academic form of a playdate or something, a long-term one. So we decided to do a research project together. And given our skills, Denise is really an expert on leadership, organizational leadership, and in particular, women's leadership, on the Sabbath and all kinds of things related to faith at work. She has a long history in that area. And I am an expert on the faith and science interface, particularly how scientists understand their work and its relationship to their faith. And so we're like, wow, we could do this like mega faith at work research study. And I think I'll just say too that both of us are passionate about doing work that is relevant to the church writ large and using our research skills to try to bring some light, shed some light on things that sometimes are in the shadows in congregations. And so we were both passionate about that too, which made us, I think, really compatible.
Yeah. So we just have a long-term friendship at this point. We've known each other for over a decade and we've been doing research together now for 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's great to hear about your shared love of walking too. I'm very committed to my 10,000 steps a day, even to the point where at 11 o'clock at night, I'm trying to get 1,000 steps around our kitchen island, driving my family crazy.
I hear you, John, and I have done it. Yes, but
we're in that group together. Well, I've had a chance to work with both of you at some level. Denise, more directly with you at Seattle Pacific University, and then on the Theology of Work project. And so I know your commitment to the Faith at Work movement. And Elaine, we haven't talked about this. We were just catching up off the air, but Science for the Church, I'm the chair of that board. And I know you know some of the players involved with that. And so our paths have crossed in that. And I'm just so grateful for the work you're doing to help the church understand and equip its members to really engage all of life and all of the professions and all of the academic disciplines in a way that's really meaningful. It makes a difference. And I think is a really credible witness for those who are watching and observing the Christian church.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's a huge compliment.
Yeah. Let's get started on the conversation about the book. Again, the title of the book is Working for Better, A New Approach to Faith at Work. And I would love to just start off with a simple question. Who did you write the book for? And what do you hope comes out of the hard work of writing this book?
So this is kind of a tricky question to answer, especially when you're pitching a book to a publisher, because they want you to have a singular answer to this question. They want you to have a very specific idea of who your audience is. And we do have a specific idea of who our audience is, but we have two audiences in mind for this particular book. One of our audiences is Christians who work. So just very broadly, Christians in the workplace who are interested in thinking about how their faith should make a difference in the workplace. But the other audience that we have in mind is leaders in the church. And so a secondary kind of purpose for this book is helping church leaders think about how do they support their congregants in their work. Right. And so both audiences really were interested in the faith and work intersection. But we think there's two leverage points there. And both audiences we think are really important in this book in terms of thinking about some of the ideas and some of the data that we have to present.
Yeah, that's really
helpful. You can sometimes find, John, when you do research with people, that sometimes they're talking past one another. Mm-hmm. And I think we found that in this study in a way that really shaped how we wrote Working for Better. We found that everyday Christians in workplaces really want to find creative ways to bring their faith, to live their faith at work, and they want to hear about those ways in their churches. We also did some research with pastors and other church leaders and found out that they sometimes think they are doing that already, mm-hmm. but that the people in their congregations don't see it as such, don't think that they are. And so I think that was really made it click for us that we wanted to address both of those audiences, people who are Christians in workplaces as well as pastors and leaders of different kinds of faith organizations. And we'd be so delighted if people outside the Christian tradition read the book as well. And we have a lot of other writing from this project that is geared towards an even broader audience.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. This is a lead into kind of the next direction I wanted to move. Why is a robust theology of work so important at this moment in the life of the church, the life of our culture more broadly? How can a theology of work or helping people in the marketplace understand how faith informs their work? Why is it so important?
I would say, and actually I'm going to take a little bit of an issue with the way you framed your question, because I don't think it's just important now. I think that this is always important. I think this mm-hmm. is always an important question. It's always an important question for how do we engage our faith in whatever it is that we're doing, because people are spending so much of their time in the workplace. And so you think broadly, if you're working full time, you've got 40 hours a week, that's a significant part of your life. If you're spending mm-hmm. a significant part of your life in any given place, what does that mean for how you live out your faith? What does God want you to be doing there? How is that place shaping you? What does God want for you in the context of that faith-shaping experience, whether you think it is or not? Uh-huh. And how are you living out your life as a Christian in every aspect of your life, but particularly in the church, or I'm sorry, in the workplace?
Yeah. Thank you. That's helpful. Elaine, anything you want to add?
I do think there's a little bit of uniqueness in this moment, and we address this a little bit in Working for Better, in that workplaces are one of the only places where most people find those who are different than they are. So in our modern world, and particularly with a huge proliferation of social media, we can kind of narrow our channels down to just the types of people that we want to be around. But still, in some types of workplaces, people are interacting with those from other religious traditions, those who do not have any kind of religious tradition. And so there is a very special need to to just think through how can I remain distinctively a Christian and yet live out my faith fully in what are sometimes very pluralistic work environments. So a theology of work has always been needed. I totally agree with Denise on that, but it maybe needs to be, I don't know, is this the right word to use, kind of tweaked or...
How about contextualized?
For
our particular moment, which is an increasingly pluralistic world, particularly in the United States, which is where we did the bulk of our research. As we engage with people who are quite different from ourselves, what does that look like?
Yeah. And I think it's a refreshing topic or maybe a central topic to get back to that can feel refreshing in the tribalistic kind of culture mm. that we're living in these days, where in some ways this is so central, so core to so many hours that we spend working and serving. And we can all agree, or many of us can agree, no matter the other ways that we might divide ourselves, that faith does inform our work. And that we have a lot of potential to serve in the workplace. So in some ways, I'm grateful for the conversation because it, in a lot of ways, brings us back to basics.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. And helps us understand how, I think, just how creative God is. You know, that there is like kind of endless ways to integrate our faith with all kinds of different work. And even within the same job, the kind of different tasks, like even the mundane tasks of work. Right. Can be used to honor God. So that was kind of a neat way that I think both of us grew through just doing this research.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this book is different from other contributions or books in the faith and work genre. And I wonder if you could talk about some of the differences. I do want to get into the data. That's really important. I want to unpack that for our listeners and viewers. But I know there are other ways that this is a unique contribution. Could you share some of the ways that you tried to offer something that was different than some of the other works that are in this space?
I'll just say one or two, and then Denise, I'm sure you'll have lots to add. But I think the data is a pretty big distinctive in that we very much start with the data. We wanted to understand a variety of workers in a variety of different regions of the country. And we wanted to understand people who see their work as a calling and people who don't see their work as a calling. Mm-hmm. So our desire just to get the whole lay of the land of Christians in the U.S., I think makes the work really distinctive and points out some problems that we have as Christians and some potential solutions. We also, often in heavily data-driven works, there's not this kind of personal feel or devotional feel. And we tried really hard in the book to make it deeply practical, to provide spiritual reflection questions at the end of each chapter, and really to tell our own stories, to not remove ourselves from the work.
Yeah, and I think all of that is really important and good. So thanks, Elaine. I would say that there's been so much written about faith and work over the past 20 years or so, and much of it's very good. So this is not a denigration of any of that at all. But as we were reading that, we were like, oh, there's something missing. And the missing piece really is this more empirical approach. Much of the faith and work literature has been written from the perspective of someone who is living out their faith in the context of their work. And again, that's really good and important, but it's a singular perspective. And we wanted to provide a very broad perspective of, you know, a range of different approaches to faith, a range of people in terms of their commitment to faith, a range of kinds of industries, a range of kinds of jobs, a range of regions in the United States. So it's a much, much broader approach to thinking about faith and work. And then I guess the second thing I would say is that much of the work that has been written about faith in the context of the workplace is directed to what then can I do as an individual? How do I live my life in a way that's faithful? Again, very good. Like, you want that. But it tends to be very focused on the individual and what things the individual can do in an ethical way. So don't lie, don't cheat, you know, maybe share your faith in a proactive way. Again, I'm not having issue with that. It's just a particular and a narrow kind of approach to thinking about faith and work. And we wanted to engage it a little bit more broadly. So we come at this with different disciplinary perspectives. Elaine is a sociologist. I'm a professor in a business and economics department at Wheaton College. Elaine is in a secular context. I'm in a Christian context. And we wanted to bring our unique kind of research sensibilities to this particular project, the sociology as an academic endeavor is very oriented to these large scale data sets that can tell you a lot. I tend to be more oriented towards organizations and towards individuals in those organizations. And so we tried to bring both of those mm-hmm. to bear in this book.
Yeah. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the data set. There were two waves of data. Speak to that, because you spoke to a number of individuals. You had a lot of personal conversations, but you also did broad survey work as well.
Yeah, we actually started with focus groups, which you didn't mention. So we did focus groups in several different cities across the country. We talked to pastors. We talked to Christians in those pastors' congregations, which actually gets back to Elaine's comment earlier about this disconnect. And pastors were saying, I talk about work all the time. And their congregants were saying, actually, I don't think I've ever heard my pastor talk about work. Mm-hmm. And it was the same pastor in the same, you know, in the same church.
Right.
Which was crazy because we did, like, we got sometimes focus group participants from a congregation where we were also interviewing their pastor. So Denise is exactly right.
Yeah. So then we set up a very large scale survey, and we did, we had Gallup actually conducted the survey for us. And so we surveyed initially about 12,000 people across the United States. And then we did some follow-up interviews with a number of those people. And then we actually did a second tranche. And so, John, your point about two waves of research are correct. After COVID hit, we realized that some of our data might be obsolete. And so we wanted to go back and reevaluate and look at some of the things that might have changed. And so we did a second tranche of surveys and a second round of interviews. And so overall, we surveyed almost 16,000 people and interviewed almost 300.
Yeah.
And did lots of focus groups. And we should put a plug in for the Lilly Endowment, which funded the research and was wonderful enough to fund that second piece of the study, too, that was towards the end of COVID. So we just learned so much because workplaces changed so much during COVID.
Yeah. And you do a nice job for those who read the book. And I really encourage you to do that. There's the addendum. I think there's an appendix that mm-hmm. goes into the data in a lot of detail, which is really helpful.
Some people won't want to read that appendix, and that's fine. You can actually totally understand the book without getting to the appendix. But for those of you who like data, the appendix might be interesting.
Exactly. It's there if you want it. You have a unique approach in organizing the book. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about its structure and what thesis does the structure support? There is an overarching thesis. I'd love for you to speak to that. The whole book, the flow of the book moves towards addressing that thesis. Share with us what the structure is and what your overarching thesis is.
Well, the structure is set up kind of uniquely for books like this, where we write a chapter about sort of a typical way of approaching faith at work. And then we talk about a new way that we think through the data we've gathered and through our own theological and spiritual reflection that we should approach faith in the workplace and that would be very helpful in these times. So the book moves through these five tensions. So moving from, for example, viewing work as secular and that's best done, you know, just to make money, say, to viewing work as having the potential to be sacred. You know, a second one is expressing faith in the workplace as a matter of potentially protecting ourselves and a concern that Christians have about their own experiences of discrimination, to moving towards thinking about protecting others as being part of our mission as Christians in the workplace and really protecting those who are perhaps not Christians alongside those who are Christians and are being marginalized. Do you want to jump in, Denise, or you want me to say that?
What I was going to say, so we have a total of five tensions, and we certainly can talk about each of them. But let me get back to John's earlier question about the kind of the overarching thesis, which is we really believe that Christians should engage in the workplace in an orientation of radical embrace towards the other. And so it's the idea that we are going to be working with people who are quite different from us, who don't share our belief set. And what does that look like? And how do we engage appropriately with them? And so we move towards, in the end of the book, we talk about this idea of principled pluralism and the notion that we should know very clearly what we believe and where we stand. And we should be open to hearing from and respecting others with the same deference that we want them to give us. And so being willing to listen to an approach and a belief set that might not align, in fact, probably won't align with our own, whether that's a different religious orientation or a nun, you know, somebody who doesn't believe anything, and giving people room to share and express their own set of beliefs while not giving up on ours and being willing to articulate what we believe as well.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Denise, I wonder if you could fill out the tensions. Elaine spoke to the secular versus sacred, the protecting ourselves versus protecting others.
Sure.
Yeah, walk us through the three remaining.
Sure. We've got three others. We talk about the importance of individual responsibility, but that that's not enough. And so we shift also to this idea of systems or communal thinking. And I kind of alluded to that earlier in our conversation, mm-hmm. the idea that it's important to do the right thing, but it's also important to step back and say, what is it about the structure that might be creating challenges mm-hmm. for particular people? And how do we change structures? So that's the third tension. The fourth tension has to do with gender roles. And so this particular tension is a little bit unique relative to the others, because here we address the ways that gender has been engaged in the church and the implications of the ways that gender has been addressed in the church for the workplace. And right. so moving from more restrictive gender roles to the idea of that men and women should be flourishing together, both in the church and in the workplace. And then our last tension is verbal proclamation of our faith. So talking about faith proselytizing and towards this notion of principled pluralism, which I just talked about. And then let me add one more, which we don't actually say at the beginning of the book. We say we've got five tensions, but the truth is we have six, because our very last chapter is a chapter on rest. And I would say that that tension is the whole book up until that point is talking about work and the importance of work. And we end with the importance of rest. And so that tension of both working well for the Lord, but also the notions of Sabbath that get embedded in the ways that we should be living a rhythmic life.
Yeah, I actually thought about it in the form of a tension of rest versus the Protestant work ethic. These
yeah. mm-hmm.
these historical things that carry into our culture, that our value is rooted in our productivity, right?
Yes.
And that's the way that we measure success. And there is a more theologically sound and biblical way to think about the rhythms of
work. That, in fact, is not how God measures our success.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right.
Thank you for being direct with that. That is right.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
I want to get into some of this in a little bit more detail. I wonder if you could speak to the individual responsibility versus a more systems or communal way of thinking. I think that tends to be challenging for a lot of workers, Christians in the workplace, to make that transition. What are examples of maybe systems thinking where a field of vision is widened? You're thinking about yourself and taking personal responsibility, but you're starting to think more organizationally about where you can correct things that maybe are broken.
Elaine has a really good story on this, John, so I want to make sure she starts with this one.
Yeah, no. Well, I think we kind of really were burdened about this particular tension because many Christians who have talked about faith in the work come from a Protestant background where there is this kind of emphasis on, you know, my personal relationship with God and God telling me what to do. And I think there's a kind of goodness to that, that we can know God ourselves in a way that's, you know, somewhat unmediated. But sometimes that then sensibility leads into thinking only about my personal ethical responsibility and not how I can change the organization or might even have a responsibility to change the organization that I'm part of. So individual thinking is, you know, seeing someone being discriminated against and perhaps comforting them, saying, you know, mm-hmm. I have some kind of responsibility mm-hmm. to make sure this person gets some comfort after that. And of course, systems thinking would be, you know, going to your boss or another leader in the organization and say, you know, there are people in my organization that are experiencing discrimination and our organization needs to do something about that. The whole organization needs to become more just. So I'm reminded, I think the story Denise is referring to is several years ago, I was on a plane coming into an airport in the Midwest. And when we landed, the power was out in the entire airport. And it wasn't that long after September 11th. So, of course, people were absolutely freaked out that perhaps another terrorist attack was occurring. And when we got into the airport, The people who lead the airport were actually literally standing there with their heads in their hands, you know, like this, like it just was so unusual that they didn't really have a procedure for what to do when the entire airport power was out. You know, where would people go to the bathroom? They couldn't exactly let people out of the airport, then let them in, and all their systems were down. So they locked us into the airport without any food or ability to use the toilet. I mean, it was really a difficult situation. But there was one woman, and it was her job, apparently, to go around and make sure that people who needed it had wheelchairs. And so she, you know, did that herself. I was watching. And then she starts gathering other wheelchair workers to her until she has a fleet. I didn't even know there were this many wheelchairs in a whole airport, but she has like, you know, 75 or to 100 wheelchairs with all with attendants. And she is going around the entire airport, making sure that everyone who needs it has a place to sit if they have a disability. And I thought, okay, this woman is not at the high, you know, end in the airport in terms of leadership, but she's really using her position of power to make sure that a need is met throughout the organization. Rather than just taking her one wheelchair to a person, she's leading a whole team of people with wheelchairs and addressing a need. And she's thereby changing the system of how things are being done in that moment of crisis. So I think it's when Christians start to move into thinking about organizations and whole systems of pain and, you know, as we say as Christians, really of sinful systems, and start thinking, wow, what's my responsibility to address some of this? That's, I think, more of a systems approach rather than just an individual approach.
And I think that story highlights two or three things that we talk about in the book with respect to systems thinking. And the first is that as Christians, we need to be aware of, we need to be watching, we need to be noticing where systems are creating problems for other people. So what are the frictions? What are the challenges? What are the things that other people are experiencing negatively? And we need to be aware of those, whether we are experiencing them or not.
That's right.
Then the second thing is we need to be culture shapers. We need to be looking for the ways that we can contribute positively to a culture. And that partly involves us being aware of the power that we have. And everyone has some measure of power, even if your job is to push wheelchairs at the airport. You've got some power. And so how do you use the power that you have? Now, that means some people are going to have more responsibility because some people have more power in organizations and other people may have less. But everyone has some responsibility to identify the ways that they can contribute to the system that is going to be positive and result in positive outcomes for people.
Yeah, that's really helpful. It's also just a really vivid example of radical embrace, right? That you're sort of outside, you've moved outside of yourself, you're thinking about your colleagues or customers or the patrons of the airport, and you're really trying to serve them. And no matter your level of responsibility or seniority in the organization, you can exercise agency over the unit that you're responsible for. It may just be one other person. It may just be you. It may be that you can have a conversation with a supervisor if you don't have any team members to help change the system for the better. So that's a wonderful example, I think. And nobody's off the hook, really. I mean, we all have an opportunity of this, no matter where we find ourselves in an organization.
Yeah.
I love that.
We all have an opportunity. And I'll just add that even if it doesn't always go well, you know, what's coming to mind is a fellow we interviewed who noticed that women were sometimes being discriminated against in the organization where he worked. And he tracked this and then went to a boss, and he felt that he was eventually fired because he was bringing up things in the corporation that other people didn't want to hear. And I thought, wow, like God also calls us to be courageous at times. And you know, easy for me to say, right, and when pointing at someone else and how they should be more courageous. But that story, you know, which was a research interview, really stuck with me and kind of changed me too. And I thought, well, where are the places where I can be more courageous too?
Yeah, great example. I think we're going to put a matrix up on the screen. I'd love to explore this with our listeners. I thought this was really helpful. This is a 2x2 that you develop in chapter 3, and this is just our photocopy right out of the book. So it's a little grainy, but it's coming right from the book, but much clearer in the book. But I'd love to have you walk through this matrix. This was new thinking for me, and I thought really helpful. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what drove the development of this matrix. What does the vertical axis represent, and what does the horizontal axis represent?
Yeah. So this really came from the people that we talked to. So we didn't come to this research with this idea at all. But as we were reading through the responses that people gave us to questions about calling in particular, we started to realize that people were thinking about calling in different ways. And so one of the dimensions, and I'll start with the horizontal dimension there, says intrinsic on the left and extrinsic on the right. Some people would say things, well, my job is a calling because what I do on my job impacts people in certain ways. Mm. And they would talk about the tasks of the job itself. The job was intrinsically a sense, it was giving them a sense of calling because intrinsically what they were doing on the job was meaningful. And then other people would say things like, well, you know, when I go to work, I'm able to talk to people at work, or I'm able to use the money that I make at work to do something else. So the tasks that they were doing at work didn't seem to be particularly important to them when they were talking about whether God was calling them to their work, but it was rather the place of work, the experience of work was allowing them to do something else. And so we said the work itself here is extrinsic to a sense of calling. And so both of those could be true. Like you could actually have, you could find yourself on both ends of that. You could say my work is both intrinsically a sense of calling and extrinsically a sense of calling. But we did hear both of those examples. And then the vertical dimension also has two kinds of anchors to it. And again, these are not mutually exclusive. So you might be able to locate yourself both places. But one is at the bottom, it's within the workplace. And so what am I doing and how is it impacting people? And some people were talking about very specifically the people that they engaged with at work. Those might be coworkers, those might be customers or suppliers or something else. And then other people were talking about out there. So sometimes people's work wasn't an immediate impact on who they were working with or who they saw, but it had an impact in the world out there. And sometimes that was because they were using resources from their work to, you know, provide funds to their church or for their family. Sometimes it was because they felt like what their work was doing or the tasks of the work or the goods and services provided in their work were impacting the world in some positive way. So it's kind of close to and far away from the location of the work. And because we've got two dimensions and because we are academics and we like to do this kind of thing, we created a 2x2 framework, which then, as you can see, has four quadrants. And we have examples of people who are in each of these quadrants who are thinking about their work as a calling in particular ways. Our goal with presenting this is not to say that one of these quadrants is better than the other. In fact, our goal is to help people kind of expand their sense of what calling could be. So if you easily find yourself thinking about calling as, you know, my work is a blessing from God, God has called me to this place, I feel like that's that lower left-hand quadrant. Are there ways that you could also think about your work as a calling in the other three quadrants? Could you think of your work as serving the world beyond you? Could you think of your work as an opportunity to engage with people who, you know, could be supported by you in some meaningful way? Could you think about your work as a way to support your church or support your family or something like that?
And Denise really took leadership in developing this, so I want to give her credit for that. But it's been incredibly useful and true to what's happening right now. People ask us about it all the time. So it really works for people. One of the examples we use is there was a person we interviewed who worked with a Subway, and he really loved working with Subway. He felt as a Christian that he was doing very special work in the in industry and fast food, where sometimes food is not as healthy. And he thought, you know, he had this deep sense of purpose that was very intrinsic to the work he was doing. But he also served beyond the workplace by providing healthy meals for people out there and making a difference in people's nutritional lives. So, you know, there are ways in which you can, you know, start to see things more broadly, which was fun for us.
So each of the four quadrants can be an honest expression, a genuine expression of sacred work. Is one of the quadrants more aligned with radical embrace? Or could you live into a vision of radical embrace in each of the four quadrants?
You know, nobody's ever asked us that question before, John, and I've never thought of it until this minute. So, Yeah, go ahead, Elaine.
Oh, sorry, Denise. I think you can live into it in each of the four quadrants.
Yeah, that's what I would say too.
Yeah, I really think you can. You know, sometimes it's easy for me, right, to think of my work as a calling because of the way that I work with students and I feel the kind of research that I do under certain conditions helps the world. So there's just all kinds of ways I can think about my work as a calling. But, you know, some work is much harder to think of as a calling. but still you do get this sense that there is this, what's coming to mind is this phrase, like this extensive creativity of God, that people can find that calling in each of these ways of seeing faith being integrated, their work and the meaningfulness of it. So another example of, from someone we interviewed was this fellow who worked in a meat packing plant. And we interviewed a lot of people from different kinds of jobs and people who did, you know, very intensive factory work is, you know, I think some of the hardest physical labor that you can do. And he really felt like it was very important work that he was called to, in part because he was really helping the people he knew at work. He said that those in his workplace, was this the one, Denise, where they called him Yoda?
Yoda, yes, exactly.
because he was so good at helping people when they were struggling with their marriages, when they had other kinds of personal problems. He created this deep network where his calling really was totally within the workplace. He was helping all these people at work, but it really was extrinsic to the work itself. He never talked about the act of packing meat. I mean, and I do think there could be a way in which that could be done in a very, in a way that really honors God and one could feel a calling into that type of work. He talked about it very much as extrinsic to the work itself. So that was a kind of cool example. I want to talk about calling being a double-edged sword, but maybe you'll ask us that as well.
Oh, this is a perfect time. Yeah, dive into that.
Yeah, as even as I said that, thanks for allowing us to talk about that quadrant, because I really love to hear Denise talk about that. I want to be careful how we use calling. Denise and I talked about this a lot, and we talk about it in the book too, that sometimes calling can be used to justify a bad work experience, a work experience that people ought to leave because it's unjust. Maybe they ought to find a different type of work or address something in the workplace. Sometimes feeling called to your work allows you to overlook injustices in the workplace. And we found through our survey statistically that people who feel called to their work are more likely to say that people should just, you know, kind of, this sounds too pejorative, but kind of suck it up and go about their workaday business, that they are less likely to notice other people's struggles as well. And so there is this kind of two-sided ness towards calling that we want to point out. And I think our critical listeners will feel blessed by that to just make sure that we aren't at all Pollyanna-ish. You know, calling does not have to be inconsistent with seeking justice in workplaces.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you for that clarification. Let me turn to this idea of rest. Many of us struggle with it. I know I do. Why is rest or Sabbath so important? And you offer some practical examples of how to move into a more Sabbath rhythm of rest. I wonder if you could share some of those examples.
Yeah, let me just say quickly that to your first question of why is this important, why is rest and Sabbath important? I would say that my interest in the faith and work movement very broadly started probably 25 or 26 years ago when I was a young mom and I had at the time two kids under two. I subsequently had two more kids, but so this idea of rest became really critical to me in a very, you know, critical moment of my life where I was like, how does this whole thing work? How does this whole Sabbath idea, how am I supposed to be doing that? And I came from a faith tradition, obviously Christian, but it was not one that emphasized Sabbath or the practice of Sabbath. And I was like, you know, that's one of the Ten Commandments. Maybe I should kind of explore that. And so my kind of entree into the faith at work movement was through this idea of rest and through this idea of what does it mean for me? And I actually worked with a couple of colleagues, and this was still at Seattle Pacific University, John, but before you got there, and two of my friends and colleagues who together, the three of us ended up with 12 children in not in common, but total. And, so we were very interested in this concept and we did several research papers on how do organizations approach Sabbath and so on. But that became my interest. And it has obviously changed and morphed over time. And Sabbath is not the only thing I'm interested in. But it was, like I said, the entree to thinking about faith and work. And I think our culture does not really denigrates the idea of rest. It really elevates those who work all the time. We have kind of kudos for saying we're busy. When I tell people I don't work on Sundays, which is now my practice, my habit, I kind of get the side eye sometime. Well, maybe you're not really, you know, maybe you're not really committed. And so it's a very interesting tension that we have and that we try to, we're trying to address with this chapter. Elaine, do you want to talk about some of the specifics with examples?
Yeah, I mean, I've learned so much from you, Denise, who's written pretty widely about this. And hopefully it's clear to the listeners. It certainly will be clear if you read the book. But both of us, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here, Denise, both of us really struggle deeply with this. I mean, I'm like the person who rewards myself after I have written a certain amount by allowing myself to go to the bathroom. I mean, so there's sort of like this, you know, we both come from families that really valued hard work. Mm-hmm. And so we were raised to, you know, put in the hours, you know, to have in a writing sense, to have your butt in the seat just working, right? And so I think, you know, during the time that I was writing this book with Denise over the years when we collected this data, I had two concussions through just very different circumstances. I had accidents that led to a concussion. And when anyone who's had a concussion knows that part of the remedy is to just spend lots of time in total silence without much stimulation. And so when I had all these deadlines, I was really forced to rest. And so just started thinking about that. And I don't think developing a way of rest that honors God is only, you know, working full out as hard as you possibly can on 6 days so that you can collapse on the seventh. Although having a weekly day is certainly part of that and certainly a very, very important discipline for most of us. But it's also having more of an attitude towards rest as well, where we know that our worth does not come from what we do ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we need lots of reminders of that, you know, one day a week, but sometimes people take a rest once a month. We need reminders through yearly kinds of rests that we call vacations or in times off. We need reminders throughout the day and in like micro rests. And so we talk about all of that. And it was a really wonderful, you know, chapter to write together, which I think is much more, which certainly draws from our data, but is also draws a lot from our own reflections and the kinds of things that have worked for us to really attend to rest in our own lives.
Yeah. And I guess one other thing I would say about this is that we do give some practical examples for, you know, the daily, the weekly, the monthly, the annual kind of approaches. I would also say that we are not perfect in how we do this. Like, this is something that we are still working out in terms of our own practices and struggling with, to be honest.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And there is a high call for organizational leaders to think about this as well. So we have to work this out in our own personal lives, but we have to think about this more systemically.
Yeah, going back to the systems, right? Going back to structures.
That's right. How does our organization either support or take away from rest and margin in our employees' lives? Yeah, it's really, really a helpful chapter. Well, I want to start winding down, but you know, there was so much rich data here. I wonder if anything surprised you about the data. Anecdotally, I was really surprised with the inverse relationship between finance and knowledge work and self-understanding of work as a sacred calling. That to me was really interesting, that knowledge workers might struggle more with this integrative pattern of connecting faith and work. Hopefully I'm not stretching beyond what the data said, but to me that was really interesting. I wonder if there were other dimensions of your research that just really surprised you.
Yeah, calling was one of those areas where we saw some kind of interesting, maybe counterintuitive kinds of findings at times. So the kinds of jobs that people said, oh, this feels like a calling to me, tended to be very much service-oriented jobs, and
that's
particularly things that were like, well, first of all, anything in the church. So anything that if you're a pastor or something, then you clearly have a calling. But beyond the church, it was things like if you're a doctor, if you're a nurse, if you're helping people with their physical ailments, then you've got a calling. Or if you are involved with social work, that's a calling. But if you're in finance, maybe not so much.
Not so much.
So there was this kind of this elevation of certain kinds of jobs relative to others, which was kind of interesting. We also found that in terms of the level in the organization, those who were at the top of the organization were more likely to say that they had a sense of calling compared to those at the bottom of the organization. Now, I don't want to overstate this too much, because overall what we found, and this is another surprising finding and maybe kind of negative, only 1 in 5 people said that they had a sense of calling. So 80% of our respondents said, I don't have a calling. But of the 20%, you know, there was roughly 20% who did. And those folks were overrepresented by people at the top of the organization and underrepresented by people at the bottom of the organization. And that maybe suggests that if you don't have a sense of autonomy, if you don't have control over your work, you're not going to experience it in the same way as somebody who does have more power in the organization. But the last thing that was kind of surprising to us, and again, it's going to sound counterintuitive to what I've just said, is that people who made more money had less of a sense of calling than people who made less money. And so then you're like, well, how can that be if people at the top of the organization and people who make the least amount of money both have a sense of calling? And actually, those two do come together in some odd way, because it's, think about people who are at the top of their organizations who don't make very much money. It's in the nonprofit world. And so those folks really do experience a sense of calling in ways that people who maybe are working in the for-profit world are not in the same way.
Yeah, fascinating. Elaine, anything for you?
Yeah, I in some ways was surprised that so few people feel their work is a sense of calling. And just because that's been very much a robust part of my own spiritual heritage, talking about these things really from the time I was in a campus fellowship in college onward. And so, and how in some ways, how easy it is for people to feel a sense of calling, that there are ways in which, you know, talking to someone who just gives you a slightly different way of seeing things, a pastor giving a sermon that's more robust. We also, you know, ask people in interviews where they heard these things talked about, where a pastor uses more robust examples that might include your occupation, you know, values work of both men and women. So it's kind of rare feeling a sense of calling. And I was surprised by that. And I was also surprised by how easy it is to inspire people to feel a sense of calling. And yet it's still somewhat rare. And that there's this kind of double-edged sword with calling, that feeling called then does blind us to other kinds of things under certain conditions. I have loved writing this book with Denise, and it's been such a privilege to listen to all of the stories and to analyze the data and then try to spiritually reflect on it ourselves. It's just been a really fun project and really meaningful.
And we're still friends, which is actually the other nice thing that comes out of this.
Yeah, very much so. And I know the book probably, you probably turned in the manuscript a year ago, because the publishing process does take some time and it's just now coming out. What are you working on now? What projects are before you now? I know you're on to new, maybe related things, but we'd love to hear a little bit about what you're working on.
Yeah, we don't have a common project that we're working on at this moment, although we have talked about the possibility of extending this research to a more international context.
That's right.
The data that we gathered was exclusively in the United States, and we'd love to expand that. I'm working right now on a project related to calling specifically, and looking at the factors that influence students' sense of calling as they go through college and beyond. And so it's a four-year project that I'm working on with a couple of psychologists, one at Colorado State University and one at University of Florida, and gotten a pretty significant grant to examine this. And so we'll see some books hopefully coming out from that project in about 5 years.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I run an institute at my university called the Banyak Institute for the Study and Advancement of Religious Tolerance. So I'm looking at a lot of things related to religious pluralism and religious violence in these times. And then right now I'm writing another book about how we use both science and medicine and faith to understand our bodies and care for our bodies. So that's my whole science and faith world that I talked about at the beginning. So working on that right now. But we also are doing our common project right now, of course, is talking about this book and getting out there and speaking. We're going to lead a retreat for my church, actually, in a few weeks. And so that's really exciting. So maybe there's someone listening who wants to invite us to do something. And we're just excited to talk more about this book, too.
That's wonderful. And Denise, you're going to travel out and be with Elaine at the church retreat?
Yes, we'll be together for that.
Isn't that fun?
Wonderful. That's great. Well, I can't encourage listeners and viewers enough to pick up a copy of the book. This is a wonderful contribution. Elaine and Denise, thank you so much for your time with us today, and just blessings on your continued work in both of your university settings.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Don. And for you
thank
as well.
You so,
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.